Looking forward to speaking with you.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
It's me, but I'm not Patsy. I'm Bria, filling in at Joy on Paper Radio, the radio show for writers, for those who dream of writing, and for those who want to know the story behind the book. And it's such an honor to be here for a special science fiction themed show. I'm adjusting my mic here and I'm waving at Big Ed saying thank you, Big Ed, for all your help this morning. And I want to give a special message to Patsy, as she has been so tirelessly faithful to this wonderful show, Joy on Paper, that she has worked on for over 8 years now. I think we're going on year 9, if I'm remembering correctly. And if you're a person who prays, I just want to ask you to join me in prayer for Patsy and her family. She has family members in Israel right now. So that's just a message that I wanted to share with you. Patsy, I love you. I'm praying for you and your family. And now we are going to our very special show. We have two absolutely fantastic guests, Steve Raza. And when he gets on here, he's going to help me pronounce his last name because it's spelled a little uniquely. He is our very first guest. And for our last half of the hour, we will have New York Times bestseller Veronica Roth joining us. So we're going to start by playing the book buzz that I did for a book called Victory's Wake. And that's the book by Steve. And go ahead and play that, Big Ed, and then we'll get on with Steve.
Hello, fellow sci-fi readers. This is author Bria Burton reporting for Joy on Paper with your science fiction book buzz. Today's communique to galaxies near and far includes a 2021 Space Fleet series starter, Victory's Wake, by Daniel Gibbs and Steve Raza. The co-authored novel is Deception Fleet Book 1, available in print and ebook. Now, let's download the book buzz. The last battles have ended between the Terran Coalition and the League, but the Galactic Cold War has just begun. Intelligence Officer Jackson Adams receives new orders fresh off an undercover mission from the Coalition President himself to get to the bottom of a refugee crisis at the border world of Afindigra, where an unknown entity is suspected of human trafficking and other heinous crimes. Could it be League infiltrators, and if so, what is their endgame now that they have lost the war? Adams assembles a squad that includes flight surveillance and munitions experts, all of whom have questionable methods according to the powers that be. Still, Adam's faith in his team's abilities will be tested to the max against the nefarious enemy striking in dark corners of the galaxy, where the most vulnerable have become unwitting victims. This military space opera blends political science fiction with Mission Impossible spycraft, and it's a page-turning thrill ride that's both thought-provoking and infused with the right measure of faith and hope. Co-authors Steve Raza and Daniel Gibbs have collaborated on the 6 novels of the Deception Fleet series. Raza is a fan of all things science fiction and superhero and an avid student of history. Gibbs hopes to bring an authentic lens to military science fiction, especially around the trials and tribulation of those who serve. This is Bria Burton with your futuristic fiction fix, signing off.
Okay, so now that you've heard a little bit behind the book, we're going to bring Steve on. Steve, welcome to Joy on Paper.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I am thrilled that you're here with us. Can you correct me if I have said your last name incorrectly? Tell me how to pronounce it.
You're pretty good. Most people say it Raza, but since I'm from southern New Jersey, it winds up being Raza a little more nasally.
Uh-huh,
just because
okay.
That's how folks from southern New Jersey talk.
Understood.
So, yeah,
understood.
That does it.
Okay,
you got
great.
It.
Well, we're thrilled to be talking to you today and to talk about your book. I'm here in the studio holding up a paperback copy of your book so that on my Facebook live stream or on the YouTube channel can see what this great cover looks like. And the first thing I wanted to ask you about, now this story is very much we've got a main character, but we also have the team. So there is our spy, Jackson Adams, and then he takes on this team to go after these league infiltrators that are potentially human trafficking, all sorts of heinous war crimes. There's a refugee crisis. I mean, this is quite the large scale scope story. And then we've got this wonderful team. Can you just tell us a little bit of how you decided to build this team that Jackson essentially works with, our protagonist works with, these other characters that move, help move the story along?
Sure. I had met up with Dan online, I believe actually through the Realm Makers Consortium, when Dan was looking to expand his story world, his Terran Diaspora story world, which he started off with a series called Echoes of War.
Okay, yes.
It came out several years ago.
Yeah, we should mention Daniel Gibbs is your co-author. So yes, thank you for bringing that up.
Yep. So this is all Dan's story world that he's created, and I'm privileged to be able to write in that story world with him. And so for Deception Fleet, what he wanted to do was his Echoes of War series dealt with the last several years of this big war between the Terran Coalition and the League of Sol. And he was looking for specifically a Cold War style series. It takes place after the war. You know, there's spies running around, there's covert actions, but there's no open warfare, no open fighting, not anything that either government will admit to either.
Anyway. Right, yes.
So what we talked about was his vision was kind of a Tom Clancy Ops Center feel. So if you've ever read a few of those novels, and I had prior to this just for fun, the Ops Center series dealt a lot with, you know, you'd have an aspect that dealt with politics, you'd have one that dealt with kind of the behind-the-scenes spycraft, and then you'd have one that dealt with military or covert action out in the field. And it combined all of those elements. So that's what he was looking to work on with this series. But I kind of had free rein when it came to creating the characters,
okay,
which was a lot of fun.
Yes, yeah.
So we kind of, you know, we hit upon having these, a few members of the military, intelligence being the leaders of the team. And then it was my idea to have some civilian members, because I figured the civilian members could break the rules a little more.
Right.
And wouldn't,
yes,
be as bound by protocol and things.
And Gina, Gina's
which
one of my favorite characters, and that's her kind of MO, is she's often off doing her own thing, and everybody's like, oh, that's not by the book.
Yeah, Gina, I think, is my favorite too, actually. I mean, I like all five of the team members just because I went out of my way to give them very kind of outside personalities.
Right.
I mean, you know, you've got Warren Dwyer, who's the pilot, but also is very, not careless with explosives, but everybody thinks he is.
Right, yes.
And then Brant is you know, kind of the voice of reason on the team, who's a little bit on the more nervous side of things, but he's the tech wizard. And then, of course, Sev, the guy who's kind of he's a refugee himself, I guess you'd say. He was when he was a kid. And now he's a mercenary for hire.
And
so it was really fun combining all of those personalities,
yes,
into one cohesive unit.
Yeah, you've got this great dynamic with all of them.
Thanks. As a side note to that, one of the things that Dan had been doing also to continue interest in the book series is he put out an anthology of short stories,
okay,
last year called Courage, Commitment, and Faith, Tales from the Coalition Defense Force. And so, if people are interested in that anthology, there is an origin story, which I, before I came up with the name for the short story, I called it Jack Meets Gina.
Okay,
because it really is about how Jack and Dwyer and Brant are on their, you know, military operation, and they inadvertently run into Gina and Sev doing their own thing.
Okay,
and they cross paths and butt heads, and it's the origin of how this team first got put together.
Oh, that's fascinating. So that's something,
yeah,
if people go to your website, they could see where that short story is available.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah, all of Dan's work is on Amazon, his entire series.
Okay, so this is the first book that you, was this your first time collaborating with Daniel Gibbs?
It was, yeah. We did a 6-book series for the Deception Fleet crew. Made it into a bit of a spy versus spy thriller. as you may have caught on there, with his opponent on the other side of the line.
Yeah, that another thing is, you have a great villain here that when you get his perspective, you know, I find sometimes there's the villain that you do sympathize with. This one, I didn't sympathize much with him at all, but it's okay. It worked. Yeah. It's very Clancy-esque in that
nobody was really supposed to sympathize with him.
Yeah, he really is just a bad guy, and we want our heroes to win. So.
Yeah, I knew I could go either way with it. I'm like, you know what? I'll just back up a little bit and go with a straight up villain for this one.
Yeah, and I think you've hit a good genre to do that in this, where we're out in, you know, the deep space galaxies, this coalition that essentially has this refugee crisis. We've got all these people flooding in, fleeing from the League, and this one planet, and you can correct me if I'm saying this wrong, Afendikra, is that the right?
No idea, but that sounds good to me.
Okay, sure. So that's the planet.
It's a Greek-derived word that I kind of made up, and I'm like, that sounds great.
But we're not sure how the locals pronounce it there, but that's how we'll pronounce it. So this planet is kind of the hot spot, almost like a border planet, that all these refugees are fleeing, and then there's really not enough resources for all the people that are going there, but then the League is snatching people, and we see this villain doing his thing. So as you're diving into this world, and you talked about the parameters, how you got to create these characters within another author's created world basically. How much of the, you know, were these planets and the coalition and the League, were those already in place, and so you're just kind of taking the setting and the world and throwing these characters into it?
Yeah, so the coalition itself and the League had existed, like I said, in Dan's Echoes of War series. So he really fleshed out the story world there. And I read all of those books prior to starting on it. And so he had some parameters that, you know, I needed to follow. It's a bit like writing. It's a bit like if you were writing in the Star Wars world, have to get approval for different things to do.
Yes.
And so I could make up situations and planets. And for example, you know, the Frontier Enforcement group.
Mm-hmm.
That is like the civilian border patrol, not military, but it's a border patrol group for the coalition. He and I brainstormed when I got to that point. I'm like, okay, well, we need this kind of group, right? So we went back and forth and brainstormed how that was going to work, what its name would be, things like that. So there was collaboration on some things like that, where other things, again, with a lot of the characters, I had free reign. Portions, of course, the portions that take place with Colonel Sinclair.
Yes,
and his ship, the Oxford, and then scenes that take place with the president and his chief of staff. Those are all characters who existed before in Dan's series. So I was writing them, trying to write them as closely as to how he wrote them as well.
Yes, yeah, and there.
So it was a fun challenge.
Yes, and there is. For me, I'm a Christian. I enjoy faith when it can be infused effectively in a book. So can you talk a little bit about the faith element? And for me, it was not preachy. There were characters who had faith. Some did, some didn't. Will you talk a little bit about decision-making as an author for making some of these characters faith-based characters?
Well, that's kind of been the way I've approached a lot of my books in the past several years, is that anytime I do faith elements, and they, you know, overwhelmingly tend to be Christian, I do frame it in that way of I'm looking at the character and seeing what the character is like and how their faith comes out in them versus what the entire book says about faith in a general or preaching sense. So, you know, I had done another small series of novellas, Vincent Chen series, in which it's all from his perspective, first person, and he is a Christian. So you get more of that in a way, just because that's how his point of view is with regards to faith. With this one, it was more of a taking it character by character. So, you know, Jackson is not really, he's kind of wishy-washy, whereas Brant is like the moral center of the team. I would say.
Yes, yeah,
the
that's
moral
a good
and
way.
Faithful center of the team.
That's a good way to put it.
And then other characters, you know, yeah, and other characters, it was based on whether Dan had written them that way. And then with some of the newer ones, I had a little more license to, okay, is this character going to have Faith's strong element or not? And so some of that was just making that decision on a case-by-case basis as I went. Story.
Okay, yes. And some of the other aspects, we've got wormholes, we've got the antimatter engines. Were those already part of the world as well?
Those were already in place. So Dan's whole system of faster-than-light travel, kind of like if you're talking about Star Trek using warp drive,
yep,
or Star Wars fans know about hyperdrive. Dan's system is, I'm not sure which one it would be more similar to, but it's a drive system that generates mini wormholes, just enough to kind of vault your ship one place to the other, real fast.
Mm-hmm.
So both those networks of nations use that. The backdrop a little bit is that during the war, the League of Seoul had inferior ships, but they produced lots of them cheaply, and the Coalition had fewer ships, but they had a decided technological advantage. So in this aftermath, the Coalition still kind of has this technological edge. Their Lawrence drive, it's called, is slightly better than the League's wormhole drive. So they're able to use that to their advantage. And they do have these antimatter power systems that were experimental in Echoes of War and are now a little bit more widespread of their fleet, but the League doesn't have that technology. And so that increases your speed and your range. So, again, it gives the Coalition a little bit of this edge that they can go a little bit faster and a little bit further than the League can go.
Uh-huh. Okay, yes. And so were there any aspects in the novel that you got to throw in some tech that was your own invention, or was most of it just already established in the games?
It was a mix. So I did get to throw a few things in there, like the whole background of Jackson having this technological background where he can fix these skimmer vehicles. Yeah, it's basically just like hover motorcycles.
Right,
like the speeders that you see on Star Wars and things like that, because I've always loved those. I'm like, that'd be a good little homage to put in there.
Okay, yes.
It makes for really fun riding, you know, people zipping around on the equivalent of a flying motorcycle in it.
Oh, yes, yeah. And
That was the one I enjoyed the most. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, there's this great moment where we have our spy, you know, I think I had Mission Impossible music kind of playing in my head through some of these scenes, because you've got Jackson who's infiltrated these different, so he's basically a mechanic at one of these places he's infiltrated to try to get some information. And yeah, there's I won't give stuff away, but there's a bomb planted. And so, yeah, there's all sorts of interesting ways that you've incorporated all these great elements of the Mission Impossible feel, of the Star Wars feel, like you said, with the speeders and mashing those things together, to me, in the best sense of this compelling story.
Yeah, and it was really fun, you know, playing with that technological edge, giving Gina all sorts of fun gadgets that I just kind of made up on the fly.
Uh-huh.
I was going along, like, oh, I need this kind of thing for this thing. And I'm going, does this already exist in the story world? Doesn't look like it. Okay, that's fun. And you know, on the other side of it, I really enjoyed, you know, it didn't really start out this way, but by the halfway point of the series, I'm like, you know what? Jack and Gene are just, like, really good pals, and I'm just going to play it this way. It's almost like this brother-sister relationship,
sort of.
I mean, there's a little bit of flirtation there, of course. But there's a whole other storyline that we won't get into with Jackson and his love interest. So once that developed, I was like, wait a minute, so then she can't be that necessarily. So I really leaned harder into this whole thing of, like, they've become, you know, really close friends.
Yes.
Throughout the whole series, which I wanted to do different, because it feels like inevitably in these kind of stories, you know, the main character lead and the main female lead, there's some sort of romance that blossoms. I'm like, nah, we're not going to do that.
Yeah, and honestly,
sorry for the spoilers, but...
Well, meaning that's kind of refreshing, like that you can have this platonic relationship, they're working together, but it's also, they can be friends and it's okay that it stops there. I know there are readers who want to see romance in everything they read. I personally am not one of those readers. I was totally okay with the fact that it was platonic, but it's still this great friendship. And that I think that's what's so neat about science fiction, is that we take things in our real world and infuse it into these fantastical situations in other worlds. But we, the reader, as the reader in this case, I could put myself there. I could relate to these characters. I could see what their motivations were. So tell us a little bit about your writing background. Now, you've done this collaboration with Dan, but you also have your own novels that you've written.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I started writing, probably like semi-seriously in high school, and then a little more seriously in college, and then a lot more seriously after I graduated.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And so my first book set, which was called The Word Reclaimed and The Word Unleashed, were published by Marcher Lord Press back in 2009 and 10. And it's they were actually one manuscript originally, and they were published as two separate books. A kind of classic space opera, Star Wars / Star Trek adventure.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Leaned a lot more heavily on the faith aspect. And so I wrote several books with Marcher Lord Press for several years. That later became Enclave Publishing, with whom I have a total of 5 books now, I think.
Okay, yes, and, yeah.
And then at some point I also transitioned into working independently, so I have several different book series. You know, I've got my Mercury Hale Monster Slayer series, which is, you know, much more irreverent, kind of snarky. If people are familiar with Jim Butcher's Harry Dresden,
uh-huh,
Detective
uh-huh.
Wizard story.
Yep.
It's kind of a hallmark callback to that. You know, it's this first person kind of snarky hero. His whole thing is that he's, you know, learning how to be a responsible adult as he's tackling these world ending threats. And then I have a handful of other books with different small publishers or independently that just run the gamut from fantasy to a few smaller steampunk books, but mostly science fiction.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. And tell us where can people find your books? What's the address to your website?
So my address is steveraza.com, RZASA for the last name. And you can go there and click on the books tab, and all of my books are listed there.
It's an impressive catalog, because I'm there right now, and it's neat to see how many books you've put out. And I actually appreciate, right on your books page, you have a column on the left that says PG, and then a bunch of books, and then a column the next line down, the row down, says PG-13. That is not something I see very often with books in general.
Well, yeah, and it's some other time we could go into the whole thing of how the rating systems developed for movies and how they didn't develop for books, because it's just a fascinating history that involves Supreme Court rulings and the movie industry taking on their own impetus to do these kind of things. But it really came up because the more I went to Christian book events and things like that, you know, parents would have questions like, well, what about, you know, swearing, sex, things like that in books? And so it occurred to me, I was like, well, I can organize my books that way pretty easily without having to do individual things to all the books, you know?
And that's, that's great. And you do list this book, Victory's Wake, as a PG-13. There is a little bit of swearing. It's not pervasive, but there are a couple characters.
Yeah.
I would say...
And that was because when we were working on the series, I asked Dan about that. I said, you know, with you, and I read it in his book. I'm like, okay, so I see you have some swearing. And he had limits on those kind of things. And his philosophy on it is basically that in the military, when military guys get into harsh situations, they are definitely not clean language people. That was his take on the whole situation.
I think
swearing just kind of comes out in stressful situations. And that's why in the book it kind of ebbs and flows.
Yeah.
Because when people are having normal, quiet planning conversations, they're not swearing at all. But if they're under fire and things are going haywire and the tension is rising a little bit, then, you know, that slips here and there. But it really isn't. It's pretty mild compared to most other things.
Well, Steve, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. I'm thrilled that you were here with us. And ladies and gentlemen, check out his book, Victory's Wake, co-authored with Daniel Gibbs. Steve, have a great day, and thank you for chatting with me.
Thank you. You too.
All right. Bye-bye now. And we're going to head off to commercial, and we will be back with New York Times bestselling author Veronica Roth.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
This is Bria, and I am filling in at Joy on Paper Radio for a very special science fiction-themed show. And I am absolutely so, so excited. We have New York Times bestselling author Veronica Roth. Many of you listening probably know about the Divergent series, which became a major motion picture. And we are going to be talking to her about her book, Poster Girl. So let's start with the book buzz that I did about Poster Girl so that you can get an idea of what's happening in this book. Hello, fellow sci-fi readers. This is author Bria Burton reporting for Joy on Paper with your science fiction book buzz. Today's communique to galaxies near and far includes a 2022 dystopian, Poster Girl, by Veronica Roth. The novel is available in print, ebook, and audiobook with stellar narration by Anna Caputo. Now, let's download the book buzz. What happens after one dystopia falls to another? Prisoner Sonia leads a meager existence in the all-but-forgotten Aperture, where former delegation members are confined but mostly left to fend for themselves. When the Triumvirate offer Sonia her freedom if she can crack the cold case of a missing girl, it's a once-in-a-lifetime chance that she can't pass up. Her ocular implant from the delegation becomes a useful tool for the agent assigned to Sonia, a former friend who betrayed her entire family to the Triumvirate. Outside, the world Sonia once knew is both drastically different and frighteningly familiar. A shell of what it once was under the delegation, yet Sonia's journey exposes many of the faults not only of the current government, but of the former, leading her to question everything she has ever known and believed. Heavy with noir overtones, Poster Girl presents an all-too-plausible future through the eyes of a complex and evolving narrator. Timely and thought-provoking, this Orwellian atmospheric novel gazes unflinchingly at concepts like government overreach, censorship, and what it means to be truly free. Author Veronica Roth's other books include the best-selling Divergent series, the Carve the Mark duology, Chosen Ones, Arch Conspirator, and The End and Other Beginnings. She lives in Chicago, where her hobbies include tennis and pottery. This is Bria Burton with your futuristic fiction fix, signing off. So now that you've heard a little bit about Poster Girl, let's invite Veronica onto the show. Veronica, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, I am just so excited to talk to you. I had so much fun reading this book. And I say fun. It's not like a classically fun book, but it is so, so well written and so beautifully lyrical. I couldn't wait to talk to you about it. So let's start off by talking about this world that you've created in Poster Girl. Would you say it's accurate to call it a post-dystopian society? There's kind of a play at words here where we're talking about a girl who kind of lived through one dystopia and then is entering the next one. Is that an accurate representation?
Yeah, I think so. It's the idea of it came sort of from in my adult work. I've been exploring like aftermath a little bit, like what happens after the story that we usually hear. And this book was a little bit about like me reflecting on, you know, the dystopia I wrote to start my career. And it's a very different world in this book, obviously. But I was curious about, you know, what it would be like to have a regime collapse and to navigate the aftermath of that. And it came together with Sonia because she is on like the wrong side of history, basically. So, you know, how do you write about a character like that and find sympathy for them and also kind of unravel their indoctrination and all that? So that's where Poster Girl's world came about.
Oh, and you, it's so beautifully done. Everything you just described is done so well. It's so compelling. And Sonia's journey, so she essentially begins the story in a prison, quote unquote. It's this place called the Aperture, where the dissidents of, you know, the people that survived the last regime are allowed to live kind of in this gated off area that's very highly, you know, monitored in the sense people cannot escape, but they also have a lot of autonomy in there. So she's got this place that she's in that's like a prison, and then the impetus for her coming out of there involves a former friend turned enemy, Alexander Price. So will you just talk a little bit about the dynamic of these two characters and what inspired, you know, you talked a little bit just now about Sonia and the drive to write about a character who has this kind of coming out of one thing into another. And then Alexander comes into the picture. Tell the audience a little bit about that dynamic.
Well, I'm going to be really honest with you, which is that I knew this book would have some grim elements to it.
Yeah,
you know, I was
yes.
aware of its yes. thematic, you know, like sadness sort of. And so I was like, I'm going to give myself like a little treat.
I love that.
And so I developed a kind of like a romance. You know, it's not a huge part of the book, but I just wanted to think about the kind of person who would challenge and be interesting to Sonia. And of course, it's someone from the past. It's like the brother of someone she was basically betrothed to. And there was always like a tension between them, but they never explored it. And then he, of course, betrays her family. And so they have to figure out this kind of angsty, difficult dynamic between them, which isn't to, you know, reduce it to like a series of romance tropes. But I did really enjoy it.
Well, I have to say, it's so effectively done because the enemies to lovers trope, I had it in my head like, is this going to be, but I kind of was like, no, this is not going to be one of those. And then as the book goes on, it's just these subtle shifts that happen where the character of Sonia is learning more, not only about Alexander himself, but just about the world as she thought she knew it. And so she starts to soften toward him in these little kind of micro ways. And it's so, so beautifully done. I almost hate to use the word trope because it can have a negative connotation sometimes, but in this case I feel like you used that trope in the best way you could have in this novel to create that almost like lighthearted, hopeful spin in a very, you're right, there is a lot of grim as we learn about what happened to Sonia's family. That is, you know, she has every reason to hate this guy at the beginning of the book. And as the reader, I sympathized with that with her. So, I mean, and to come at it in that light that it's a treat for you. I love that. I just love that aspect.
Yeah, I think the serious part of it is that if you're trying to, like, unravel a bunch of lies that you've been told about the world, you need someone to bear with you in those moments and help you to see the world accurately, right? So he's that for her.
Yes.
And that they develop a romantic bond is the treat.
Right, exactly, exactly. And that, I think that's why it's so satisfying when it does turn romantic, because they walk through a lot of dark things together. And so, mm-hmm. yes, it is like this, you know, this relationship brings that kind of emotional resonance to the reader, too. And let's talk a little bit about the society and the tech specifically is what I'm thinking of. In this world, the people have something called an insight. Now, this came from the previous, called the delegation, right? Where mm-hmm. the delegation I was about to say installed. maybe that's the word for it. They installed these into people's eyes. Can you talk a little bit about the insight, what it is, what it does, and why it's kind of a important point in Sonya's, the fact that she has one?
So the insight is basically injected into the eye, like when you're a kid, and your body forms like a sort of symbiotic bond with this piece of technology that then becomes like some surveillance equipment that's like installed in your brain permanently. And this is something that everybody did under the delegation. It was required by law, but it was also like it performs the functions of a smartphone. Like you can listen to music on it. You can talk to your friends. You can get information about the world around you at, you know, in a moment. So it was supposed to be like a positive piece of technology that is then of course used to watch and also sort of behavior control the people in this society. And that's all before. So Sonya right, still yeah. has one. But, and everyone in the Aperture has one, but everyone outside has like made this type of technology illegal.
So when she leaves the Aperture to go, essentially she goes on a mission with Alexander, and she kind of stands out because she has it.
Yes, it's like a glowing orb or a glowing circle in her eye. So it's not possible to hide it.
Right, right. And for example, Alexander has what you describe called an illicit, which is kind of, it sounds like the equivalent of a smartphone, but is there more to
yes.
that?
No, it's exactly a smartphone.
Okay, yeah, yeah. But I just love the clever names, though, because it just, I think the word illicit is so, it's got such deep connotation of, you know, eliciting a response, like a cause and effect type moment with the smartphone. And then she even has this moment when she first sees him where she's like, now why would anybody want to carry that around when it can just be in your head? And that's one of those moments where the characterization of Sonya is so powerful, where the reader understands, okay, this is what she's known her whole life, this is where she's coming from. But as a reader, and I will say, as a reader who is not looking forward to the day anybody tries to ask me if I want something inserted into my brain, that's just not me, and it's probably never going to be. But that's kind of the interesting dynamic that we see where she's at, where she's come from, and that's all she's known. Kind of like Alexander, you know, he has the illicit. That's what he knows, and that's his norm. So there's also this tech where there's a character called Myth that she ends up meeting to try to get some information, and he has this like face obscuring tech. So is that at all? Remind me, because I'm trying to remember what is described. Like, does she know about the tech, or she just realizes that's what it is?
You know what? I don't remember if her knowledge of it like is from before, but I think my idea. Sorry, it's been a moment since I wrote this, but
that's okay. I just read it, and I'm trying to remember if she just thinks about like, oh, he has a face obscuring tech. Yeah.
Yes, I think if you have an insight, you know, in your eye, then you have to develop technology to kind of like escape its surveillance. So there's a couple references to like different ways to do that in the story.
Yes,
but I don't
yes.
know if she knew about it before or not. It's like an underbelly kind of thing, so
right.
and she was very much not the underbelly.
Yes, so. Exactly. In fact, as the title would let us know, she was a poster girl for the delegation, which is, you get the idea. That's one of the reasons that she is able to survive and live in the aperture, because people know who she is. There's a bit more to the story we learn later, but that, you know, she's kind of the quote unquote poster girl for that. Mm-hmm. She's part of the family that does and says the right things. And what an interesting commentary on our current world, even looking at this future world. So talk a little bit, if you would, about your writing journey with this book. Was this one of those books that just was flying off the pen and you just couldn't get it down fast enough? Or was this one of those books that you had to sit with and mull with? And tell us, if you would, a little bit about your writing process.
Well, I was scheduled at that time to write a sequel to Chosen Ones, which is my previous adult novel, my first adult novel. And the pandemic hit the first week, or the lockdown started the first week that Chosen Ones came out. And then subsequently, you know, everything just like went up in flames across the world, you know, just like, you know what? I don't think I can write this book anymore because I don't feel like this person anymore, which is maybe dramatic sounding, but I really mean it. And I had this other idea instead. But I did have to chew on it for a while because I was kind of afraid of it. It's like a darker tone than I'm used to in my work. And so I wasn't sure. I was like, can I do it? Because I think, you know, in order for the book to work, it has to have stronger prose than I was capable of at the time. And I was like, you really have to commit to it. It needs to be tight. So I was like afraid of the challenge of this book. But I was like, okay, that means you have to write it, because that's always a good sign when you know that a project will really put pressure on you to grow. That for me means like it's time for this.
Oh, that is so neat to hear. What a beautiful testimony about how a writer, and for those who listen to this show who are writers, not some are readers, some are writers, some are those who dream of writing. So to know that not every book just falls out of you onto your lap. Sometimes you do, right? Yeah, you do have to sit with it and even work through what story you're trying to tell and how to tell it in the best way. And you mentioned your first adult novel being, was it The Chosen Ones?
Yes.
And so what led you to go from YA, which I imagine many people listening are very familiar with the Divergent series, what led you to go from YA to adult? In terms of the targeted audience?
I think it was really like the ideas I started to have. I was led by them because I was just trying to wrestle with some other things in my life. You know, I think when I was writing YA, I had a lot of thoughts about adolescence and kind of ideas about those characters in that age and how like exhilarating and confusing it is. And then something just started to shift where I became curious about different questions about like how to fit into the world as an adult and how to navigate your sudden responsibility, you know, the duties that you have to like society.
So yeah.
It's not that you can't have those questions or concerns in YA, but they're not as relevant to characters of that age. You know, they're just becoming aware of themselves as an individual. They're not trying to fit themselves into like a network in the same way that you do when you leave college, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think that was the drive. You know, it was all creatively driven. I had no career strategy involved at that point.
That's also encouraging to hear for writers.
Yeah,
sometimes there's a little winging it, right?
Yes, I'm helpless against the force of my ideas. I can't be strategic in that way. I admire people who can, but I've got to do the thing.
And I think this book, Poster Girl, I'm going to hold it up for the people watching on my Facebook Live or on the YouTube channel. This book is just, I think, a testament to what you just shared, the wrestling through and the putting your heart out onto this page, because there's a lot of heart in here in the midst of the grim and the dark. And And I wanted to ask you a little bit, just in terms of the social media, the landscape that we find ourselves in our current world. I'm not sure what you're, you know, growing up in terms of like what type of books that you liked to read. Did you like to read sci-fi growing up? Did you prefer more different genres? And how did that kind of shape you entering into these types of ideas, talking about a future world where we could almost see the possibilities from our current world is kind of where I'm going with that. Talk a little bit about your background there.
Yeah, so I read almost exclusively science fiction fantasy as a child. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, it has an undeniable influence on what I'm interested in now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, mostly it was for the escapist part of it. I was a very anxious and moody child, and so reading science fiction and fantasy was a way to just like have some relief, you know, from like what was kind of like a difficult internal environment. And it's become more than that now, you know. It's like I think one of the reasons I enjoy science fiction and fantasy so much is that they ask my brain to stretch in new ways and to consider new ideas. And also dystopia specifically asks us to examine the things around us in like an exaggerated form, which in this case is of course like the kind of surveillance that we're all currently under, you know, because of our smartphones. Like, it knows where you are. The New York Times did this huge expose a couple of years ago, which partly inspired Poster Girl, which just kind of revealed how much you can find out about a person based on where they go. Like, you can find their identity. It's not that hard, apparently, according to this article. And I just found that to be so troubling. And I think that's really like where the book came from. But it's always stuff like that for me. I love thinking about, you know, where we could go, and maybe not like realistically where we will go, but just kind of like the kind of ethical and moral implications of like what we've decided to do now, if we blow them up a little bit.
Yes. I think that's perfectly worded, because in your book, as I read through it, I was thinking about, okay, this is not so far off from what could happen if, and it's that what if. I mean, that's often the question most writers ask themselves, whether they're writing mystery or whatever genre.
Yeah.
But the what if, I think for science fiction writers like yourself, tends to be like, where are we going in this world? Like, where is it headed? And I think this book is a wonderful examination of what that could be. And there's this also, there is this kind of mystery noir element, because she's on a mission to find this missing girl. So there's these wonderful collaboration that you do with different genres tied in under that science fiction umbrella. And was that something that kind of just came organically as you were writing the story, or were you trying to be really purposeful about infusing that type of feel into the book?
The noir part of it happened very much by accident. I think just because because it's just raining a lot in Seattle. I was just like, ooh, okay, let's have her be this kind of like cynical detective figure, you know, with like a dark past, which is very much, you know, kind of feels like a noir archetype that exists. You don't usually see it applied to a young woman like this, but. So that was by accident. The mystery was on purpose. You know, I knew that writing this story meant I would have to write a mystery, which I haven't done before. And let me tell you, writing a mystery is really hard.
Yes.
Because you have to know so much more than your reader or your character knows at any given moment. And it was tricky. But I do have a friend, Kara Thomas, who writes amazing mysteries. And she was very helpful in, you know, the beta reading part of this project.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, now tell me, how much, in terms of outlining ahead of time and having your notes about, okay, oh, this character, when they show up on the scene, I, the author, know that down on page, you know, 500, they're going to, yeah. So how much of that was ahead of the actual writing?
I think I had to know all of it.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is probably the most outlined book that I've ever written. And it, coincidentally, also the shortest. So I don't know, maybe not so coincidental. But I did always, like, have to figure out, you know, in this moment, like, what does she know? Or what does she think she knows? And, you know, what's really going on? And that was, like, it's like having two outlines at once. So it was really fun. I mean, I say it's hard, but I love, you know, I love when things are hard in writing. So it was pretty delightful at the same time.
And it made for a great book. So as I'm looking at your website, it looks like, so I have the hardcover copy of Poster Girl, and I also got to listen to the audiobook. It looks like it's awesome. Now in paperback as well?
That's right. It came out in paperback on Tuesday.
Oh, awesome. So that's really exciting for the readers to know. It's available in pretty much every format that you could imagine now, including paperback. When I've done this show before, I've asked authors if they listen to their own book, like to the audio of their own book. And I'm curious, have you listened to the audio of this book?
I've listened to enough of it to know that Anna Caputo rocks.
She did excellent. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's a little too soon for me to listen to it. So eventually I will listen to it because I'll kind of forget a lot about the book and I'll maybe want to experience it again. And when someone reads it to you in an audiobook, it's like you're discovering it in a new way. So
oh, right.
I always love, a couple of years from now, I will be delighted to listen to the whole thing.
Well, I always find the answers fascinating. I want to say it was... was it Edward Ashton? He's the author of Mickey 7, if you're familiar at all with him.
Yeah.
I think it was him I had on the show who was saying he does not listen to his own audio. He doesn't want to. And I'm like, that is fascinating to me because I'm not sure why, but it just is that this is something. Now, what you just said, though, kind of tips me off a little bit because it's its own medium in many ways because this person is essentially taking on your novel and putting it into their voice. So that includes, mm-hmm. you know, oh, you know, I wrote this sentence that way, but here's how they said that sentence. Interesting. So it's like what you just said is you're going to discover your own book through someone else's eyes. And I just love that, that idea.
Yeah. I mean, if you listen to enough audiobooks, you can really tell the difference between someone who's an excellent performer and someone who's maybe, you know, less experienced or not as skilled. And they can make a huge difference in terms of whether you like the story or not.
Yes, so, yes, absolutely, yes.
They change a lot, you know.
And so what would you like to share what's coming up for you? We have this as a standalone novel, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and anything coming out that you want to let the audience know about?
Yeah, so after Poster Girl, I had a novella come out called Arch Conspirator, which is a sci-fi retelling of the Greek tragedy Antigone. And I have another novella coming out next May called When Among Crows, which is Polish fantasy inspired. So
Ooh. That's
what I got.
That is fascinating. Oh, I'm so excited about those. And so where can they find you online?
I am at veronicarothbooks.com, and I'm also active on Instagram at veronicaroth.
Awesome. Well, Veronica, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for your time, for sharing just all that you've, you know, brought to this interview in terms of a very seasoned and well-known author. It's great to hear a little bit more behind the book. So I appreciate your time, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Thanks so much. You too.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Okay, well, thank you, listeners, for joining us for this wonderful show. Oh, it was so... What an amazing woman, Veronica Roth. I just loved talking to her. And when you hear how she comes up with her story of Poster Girl, it's such an emotional read. Just keep that in mind, readers, that when you go through it, there is some dark, but there's also a lot of light that comes out of it. And I just can tell she put her heart into it. So do make sure you get your hands on either the brand new paperback that's out or on the Audible or the hardcover. And be sure to check her out. So thank you all for listening, and Patsy will be back Tuesday at 11 a.m. for her next Joy on Paper. I hope you all have a wonderful day, and those in Clearwater, Florida, where we are here in the studio, I believe there's a little bit of rain out there, so be careful on the roads, and make sure if you're a writer that you're out there writing. If you're a reader, enjoy your next book. Take care. Bye-bye now.
WTAN, Clearwater.
FM 106.1.
WDCF, Dade City.
FM 102.3.
Listen.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Steve Kathan. The U.S. is involved in talks.